Okay, let me begin as usual by reminding you all about where we are so far in this part of the course. We're concerned, of course, with the Cold War. We want to understand what it was about so that we could get some sense for what the fundamental questions were that needed to be resolved in order for a stable international order to take shape. And that problem, the answer to that question is not nearly as obvious as you might think. You might think, well, it's the most natural thing in the world. You know, they're a communist dictatorship, they're facing a coalition of Western democracies. Of course there's going to be a conflict, see? But it just can't be that simple. It doesn't matter what your internal political ideology is, you have to take power realities into account. Are you going to push your ideology so hard that it's going to lead to a third world war, a general nuclear war? Say, well, if not, then shouldn't you have had a stable system coming into being practically right from the start? Shouldn't it have been the case that American power and Soviet power balanced each other so completely that neither of those two countries, let alone any third power, had any room for maneuver, any ability to seriously challenge the status quo? Wasn't this kind of bipolar structure of power that you had in the aftermath of World War II sufficient in and of itself to lead to a stable peace, to lock everyone into respect for the status quo? It obviously didn't happen that way, though, right? In a sense, you take a theory like that, this kind of realist theory of how international politics works. Okay, good. And you see, it doesn't provide you with answers. It doesn't tell you, why things happened the way they did in the Cold War. Quite the contrary. It serves to bring the questions into focus. You wouldn't see the Cold War as puzzling unless you brought a conceptual framework of that sort to bear on the analysis of these issues, right? So that's the puzzle. Why is there a problem at all? Why isn't everyone pretty much forced to accept things as they were? You know, the division of Europe, the division of the world. Huh? And as you try and sort out that question, it turns out there's one and only one answer. There's one great exception to this general rule about how the two sides could get along with each other in the post-1945 world. That general rule is they control things on their side of the line of demarcation. The United States and her friends control things on their side of the line of demarcation. That's the general rule. So for there to be a problem, there has to be an exception to that general rule. What's that exception? One and only one case Turkish and Iranian affairs run their course in 1946. One and only one case, and that's West Germany. Not Germany as a whole, West Germany. Because the Soviets cannot give the Western powers a totally free hand to do whatever they wanted in West Germany. Because if West Germany became too strong, if West Germany became a truly sovereign state, able to build up her military power to whatever level she was physically capable of, that would necessarily pose a threat to the whole political order the Soviets had established in the East. Because unlike the Western powers, West Germany was not all that happy, not all that content to just live with the status quo. West Germany was deeply opposed to the post-war status quo and craved the reestablishment of a unified German state, right? So the problem of German power had to be central. And in order to exercise some control over what happened in Western Germany, the Soviets had to pose a certain threat in order to get the Western powers to take their views seriously. But the more threatening they became, the more the Western powers were obliged to move ahead with their policy for Germany, the so-called Western strategy for Germany, the strategy of organizing the three Western zones of Germany under the auspices of the three Western powers, organizing that state first economically, then politically, finally militarily, tying that West German state into the Western world in a variety of different ways, economic, political, military, right? The more the Western powers moved ahead with that, a policy which entailed allowing West Germany to recover her political rights, to create a state, to get some control of her own destiny, you know, ultimately to build up her military power, you know, that would necessarily be viewed by the Soviets as threatening. So you have this kind of spiral dynamic. Yeah? The harder they push, the harder we have to push back, and that simply leads them to push harder still and us to push harder still back. Right? A spiral dynamic. Because you have a security dilemma situation coming into play at this particular period. Right? You have a major conflict, you don't need to have one side or the other being particularly aggressive. Countries are led to pursue policies which their opponents view as threatening for purely defensive purposes. We got to build up West Germany, not because we want to overthrow the communist order in the East, but simply in order to defend ourselves. Right? They have to challenge what we're doing in West Germany, not because they're particularly aggressive, but for purely defensive reasons. And that clash of essentially defensive strategies can lead to a conflict that holds within itself the seeds of another world war. A very important conclusion, you see? And it shows the power that international relations theory has to help you understand a bit about what was going on. And so that German question, the question of West German power, necessarily lies at the heart of the Cold War. It's the central mainspring, central engine of political conflict during the Cold War period. So therefore, if we're interested in this whole question of what's driving the Cold War, and conversely, is there a solution, is there a political settlement that both sides could have agreed upon that could have provided the basis for stable international order, we have to focus on these German issues, on the whole question of, you know, is there a chance to kind of create a relatively stable order that everyone can live with, that meaning that both defends West Germany but also limits West German power, right? And so we looked at these various points in the history of this period when it seemed like such a solution was within reach. 1945, friendly division of Europe between the two sides, right? Why doesn't that work? We talked about that, the whole story of 1946. Then 1949, that whole crisis that set off, culminating in the Berlin blockade affair of 1948-49. It seems to have run its course. Both sides seem to have accepted things. The Soviets end the Berlin blockade. Each side creates its own German state, a Western security system. NATO is brought into being in 1949. It seems like, okay, we've run through the white water, and now we've reached the end, and it's a system that everyone can live with. It doesn't lead to stable order. In fact, about a year later, the world moves into a very serious crisis, this crisis of the winter of 1950-51, when people thought a Third World War might, you know, just be a question of time. Right? And that would mean a war fought with these early fission bombs. Thousands of these things could be used. The war could take 5 to 10 years, people thought. Unclear who would win. It seemed like there was a very good chance the United States would lose such a war, right? But Soviets pulled back from the brink, and the process, excuse me, the process that the Americans embarked upon at the end of 1950 to build up their military power runs its course, and by the end of the Truman period in late 1952, the United States has overwhelming power. and thus a free hand to basically move ahead with the other Western countries in building up a Western political system. And of course, the great question here is, how will Germany fit into that system? You're asking West Germany to take her place in the Western world and thus to accept the division of her country. Because the only chance for unification is some sort of settlement which provides for the neutralization of that reunified German state. The Soviets at Orange is going to hand over East Germany to a West Germany that's going to remain part of NATO, and for the power of that unified German state to be part of the Western Bloc. Soviets are going to go along with this at all. It's only going to be on the basis that of the unified German state not being part of NATO. So the Germans are always tempted to kind of reach a deal of that sort with the East, meaning that the West has to kind of keep upping the ante in terms of what it's willing to bid for German loyalty to the West. Right? So, but the West, you know, the West has a free hand now. The question is, how will West Germany fit into the Western system? And you have this whole long, extremely complex process that dominates inter-Allied diplomacy in the early 1950s. You know, beginning with the Pleven Plan I think it was December of 1950, the idea of creating a European army, the whole business with the European defense community. I don't expect you to remember any of these things. I'm not going to ask you about the EDC, the Pleven Plan, or anything like that in the exam. But the important thing to bear in mind is it's just this extremely complicated process. You have all these military issues. What sort of armament should the Germans have? You know, how should their army be organized? What should the relationship be between the West German army and the NATO structure? You know, all these kind of what sort of presence should the Western powers have, military presence on West German territory? What should their rights, military rights, be? All these kind of political things about who's going to be responsible for West Berlin, who's going to be responsible for German unification, what role should the Germans have in any of these things, whole business with the reserved rights and so on. Yeah, you had a whole series of treaties that was signed in 1952, never ratified, because there was so much opposition to this. A big part of French policy in this period is not to actually bring about a European army, but just, you know, throw some sand into the gears of this American juggernaut, which is just pushing ahead much too fast and much too early for a major rearmament of Germany. But finally, this whole process runs its course by 1954. The French Prime Minister, Pierre Mendès-France, allows the EDC to go down to defeat in August of 54, and very quickly, on the initiative of the Europeans, basically the French and the British governments, you know, and they work out this settlement, the settlement embodied in the Paris Accords, that provides the basis for the entire Western political system for the balance of the Cold War. And what's the key thing about the Paris Accords? The Americans are in, and German power is limited. How is German power limited? All kinds of ways, political and military, but the key thing, the key limitation on German power is that West Germany is not going to be allowed to build nuclear weapons of her own. Right? Very important limitation. Because if you don't have nuclear weapons, how can you stand up to a big nuclear power like the Soviet Union by yourself? You can't. So you're dependent on the Western powers, the NATO powers, for protection. And those forces are going to have to be on your territory for geographic reasons, right? And as long as they're in their territory, that military presence is going to cast its political shadow. And there are going to be real limits to how far you can go in pursuing a purely national policy, because you're so dependent on these foreign countries, the United States, Britain, and France, that have no intention of coming anywhere close to the risk of a new war in order to support German national goals. Right? So Germany is locked into the status quo by virtue of the system established by the Paris Accords. Right? And so we have here in 1954 a third chance for peace, you'd think. finally, we're home free. Finally, we've worked out a settlement that everyone can live with. Soviets can live with because it solves the problem of German power. Right? German power is contained within the structure dominated by the United States. As long as the Americans are there in Europe, as long as the Americans basically control the NATO system, you know, there's not much that Germany can do. But the Germans could also live within in the final analysis because basically it provides them with security against the Soviet threat. Right? Yes, they have to put their national goals on the back burner, but the immediate need is to preserve their own freedom and also to preserve their own ability to remain part of the Western world, which is important to them for all kinds of reasons, you know, military, political, even moral, because it symbolizes the Germany's acceptance back into the Western world as an almost equal partner. Very important after what had happened during the Nazi period. Right? Yeah?
What did Eastern Germany, the people in East Germany, did they ever try to rebel?
Yes. There was a big rebellion in 1953. The Soviet control of the East rested on brute force. The Soviets were no doubt about that. They often told the East Europeans, the East European communists, that the only reason you're in power is because of Soviet bayonets. 1953, there was this big uprising in East Berlin against the communist regime there. Soviets had to intervene. Every few years, there's something like this. There was this big uprising in Hungary in 1956. You've heard of that. Czechoslovakia in 68. Poland was like right on the verge of this sort of thing, 1982. To this day, there's no love in Eastern Europe for the Russians. But the system was based on brute force. Once you take that away, like the Soviets did during the Gorbachev period, the whole thing was just bound to collapse. You know, people looked at the kind of collapse of the East German regimes and they said, oh, look at the great courage of the, not just East German, but East European regimes in general, the great courage of the people there and, demonstrating against the government. But it was like a foregone conclusion. As soon as the Soviet policy changed and you're not going to use force, these regimes are going to collapse. It rests on brute military force. Okay? Inherently unstable for that reason. So you have the system of the Paris Accords. Soviets could live with it, Germans could live with it. But for it to work, you needed the Americans to be involved. And the key thing to note about the Eisenhower policy at this point is that the Americans didn't like the Paris Accord system. It was accepted very grudgingly. Eisenhower and his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, they had their hearts set on the EDC. Their whole notion was the Europeans, if they could only put their antiquated nationalistic feelings aside and pool all their resources and create a true European Union, true United States of Europe, then they could defend themselves. They didn't need the American involvement. They were strong enough to do it, and they should do it. They shouldn't just be freeloaders and just kind of ride on our coattails. They should be ashamed of that, not taking their own defense seriously and just focusing on, economic reconstruction and making themselves richer and fatter. This is not what we want for allies. We're not cut out from the imperial role. That's the basic Eisenhower thinking about Europe. Okay. We didn't like it. Why was it that the system established by the Paris Accords didn't provide the basis of a stable international order? Because it didn't. We know it didn't because just a few years later, we have this whole new round of very serious crises. beginning with the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev's ultimatum on Berlin in November of 58, and culminating in the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 62. Right. That's what I'm going to talk about, you know, the latter part of the lecture. The central episode of the Cold War, this whole Berlin crisis. Why did it happen? It's because the United States was unwilling to play the role that the Paris Accords had established for America. We didn't want a continuing U.S. involvement there. We wanted, therefore, the Europeans to defend themselves. The only way they can defend themselves is by building a nuclear capability under their own control. That's the basic Eisenhower concept. Over and over and over again, he makes arguments of this sort. We don't want to stay in Europe forever. What about NATO? Well, the American involvement in NATO would gradually diminish, you know, down to the single division level, maybe even down to zero. And as the American role diminished, responsibility would devolve to the Europeans. NATO would devolve into a European security organization. The NATO commander called SACEUR, a Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, that acronym, would become a European general. Eisenhower thought a French general. Okay. That's the basic concept. It clearly implied a European nuclear capability. Multinational or international to the extent possible, but in the final analysis, if it was organized on a national basis with some sort of knitting together within some sort of supranational framework like NATO or some European defense organization, that was fine too. Okay, the basic Eisenhower concept implied a European nuclear force, and in fact, since there wasn't going to be a true United States of Europe right away, that meant the force would be organized on a national basis, knitted together, as I said, but with a German contingent. The German army, Bundeswehr it was called, the German army would be armed with nuclear weapons, with American nuclear weapons, in fact. Right? And there were two other reasons pushing toward this policy, what was called the nuclear sharing policy, the sharing of America's nuclear weapons with our European allies, allowing them to get effective control over American nuclear weapons, sharing our nuclear capability with them, helping them build an indigenous nuclear production capability, helping them also with the delivery systems and so on. Two other taproots of this policy, the whole MC48 business, the strategy for the defense of Europe that was adopted by the NATO Council in December of 1954. MC48, a strategy for the massive, concentrated, and immediate use of nuclear weapons at the beginning of a war, both strategically, that's to say against the sources of Soviet power in the Soviet homeland, and tactically in the theater against troop concentrations, the whole logistical system, weapon stockpiles, and all that kind of thing, right? The heaviest emphasis on nuclear weapons that the Western allies ever had in their military strategy, heavier than it had been prior to MC-48 during the period when General Ridgway, for example, had been SACEUR, much more old-fashioned approach, and heavier than it would be in the even in the late 50s, let alone in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Okay. Not just if war breaks out, we're going to go nuclear and do it in a big way at the very outset. It's like the implication of the strategy was we're not going to let the enemy get the jump on us. Right? As soon as we're convinced the war is pretty much inevitable, we're going to launch our attack. That's called preemption. We go first. We go first even before the enemy has done anything, even before the enemy has attacked our forces or crossed any borders or anything like that. Why? Because the precondition for the political viability of the strategy is that Western cities would not be the targets of nuclear attack. And the only way that you could assure that was the case was by destroying the enemy's nuclear force while it was still on the ground. Because once those aircraft became airborne, well, you may be able to shoot down some of them, but it was very unlikely you could shoot down all of them. And we didn't want them to be able to place any of their nuclear weapons on target, not just on American cities, but on the cities of our West European allies. And we're strong enough in 1954 to contemplate a strategy of that sort. American strategic superiority was so massive at this point that a policy of that sort was actually feasible. And because time was of the essence, that meant that authority over the use of nuclear weapons would have to be pre-delegated to the NATO commander who would make the key decision. Right? Again, very important in the history of the nuclear age, and also in the history of U.S.-European relations. But the most important implication of the MC-48 strategy for our purposes was nuclear sharing. Say, nuclear weapons are the only weapons that are going to matter. You know, they're going to be absolutely decisive at the very beginning of the war. And because speed was so essential, you know, you had to make sure that all the NATO forces, not just the American forces, but the European NATO forces, were trained to operate in a nuclear battlefield and equipped to use nuclear weapons. You know, operational readiness was crucial for this sort of strategy. So you couldn't go through this whole thing with having the weapons under tight control and stockpiles and only released when all these different codes were released and so on. You know, they had to be at the ready. And if you didn't allow the Europeans to have nuclear weapons, and you had the sort of strategy which said basically nuclear weapons are the only weapons that count, what sort of message are you giving them? Oh, well you're children, we're going to protect you, you know? That was not at all in keeping with the basic Eisenhower philosophy. These people are partners, you've got to treat them as equals. You know, how can you say they can't have weapons that our enemy, the Soviet Union, already has? How can you say they can't defend themselves against the Soviet Union by having access to the same sorts of weapons? Right? You know, you look at this stuff through the eyes of people in the 1950s. You know, these arguments are so powerful. They're so plausible. You see? And then there was the whole thing I call the shadow of parity. This system established by the big American buildup of the early 50s where America, you know, had this just absolutely massive strategic nuclear edge, everyone knew it wasn't going to last forever. Didn't mean that the Soviets would necessarily have to build a force equal to that of the United States. All they had to do was to build up a force that was large enough to survive whatever the United States could throw at them, and then go on to drop a certain number of weapons on the American homeland in a retaliatory strike. And that number of weapons that they had to be able to drop wasn't all that big, because these thermonuclear weapons are so extremely powerful that, I don't know, like 50 of them could destroy dropped on target, could destroy the United States as a functioning society. And everyone knew that eventually the Soviets would be able to develop what was called a second strike capability. They didn't have it at the time. As it turned out, they only developed it in 1963. They were actually much slower to develop it than had been thought in the 50s, you know. And that was not because they didn't have the technical skill, the material resources to do it, but they were wasting a huge amount of their military budget on stuff that was literally worthless, like air defense weapons. They spent a huge amount on air defense that would simply have been ineffective in shooting down the American bombers that would launch the attack on the Soviet Union. A lot of this was understood only in terms of the structure of bureaucratic power within the Soviet national security establishment, the great power of air defense forces bureaucratically. It didn't make sense strategically. And this anomaly, incidentally, was what gave birth to the whole bureaucratic politics paradigm, which I talked about briefly when we were discussing the Utley book, before the midterm. Okay. So the Americans move ahead during the Eisenhower period with the arming of the NATO allies with American nuclear weapons. It's not done in an overt way. Why not? Because it's against the law. We have this thing on the books, the Atomic Energy Act. The president isn't supposed to share our weapons with any foreign country, right? And Eisenhower viewed this law is unconstitutional, but he wasn't in a position to challenge it. So he basically does this end run around it. They have these phony custody arrangements that they know are just a facade, a sham. But this means that they could say that they're in technical compliance with the law. But the main goal, and they're very overt about this when they're talking to the Europeans, is that the main goal is to make sure that in an emergency, you're going to get these weapons. You shouldn't have any doubt at all. These custody arrangements are technical, token, just nominal, meaningless. Okay? And they move ahead. They actually, have all these programs for training the European allies in the use of American nuclear weapons, for deploying those weapons to the Allied armies. Actually, it goes pretty far. I mean, even Greece and Turkey were NATO allies. They had access to these weapons. And one of the fears that people had during this period is that Greece and Turkey had a big rivalry between them about Cyprus, and they might get into a war and use these American nuclear weapons against each other. I mean, this whole thing is like no joke. It was a very serious policy, Hundreds of these American nuclear weapons were deployed to the NATO forces in Europe, the non-American NATO forces in Europe. They were put on these fighter bombers, which were on strip alert, and these airfields in Europe, and if they took off and delivered these weapons to targets in the east, there was basically nothing the Americans could do about it. They had this kind of poor sentry. American sentry was standing near the fighter bomber. He'd have this weapon, didn't even know what he should do if the engine started to rev up of the aircraft. Lots of times the weapons didn't even have live ammunition. In other words, the custody arrangements were kind of a joke, but this was deliberate. People thought at the time, it's like, well, Eisenhower, he had his strokes and his heart attack, and he was kind of doddering, and all he liked to do was play golf. There's a big myth about Eisenhower, and he didn't know what he was doing, and the military gets out of control, and so on. That's not true at all. Basically, all this stuff is deliberate policy. A policy that was rooted in Eisenhower's basic political thinking, an approach which is, it's by no means absurd. You can see why he felt he had to kind of move in that direction. All right. Okay, bottom line is, the thrust of American policy in the 50s is to allow the Europeans, and especially the West Germans, to get access de facto to a nuclear capability. Well, if you're Russian, how are you going to react to this? You don't like it. I should say, it's not like these things are forced down the throats of the Europeans. They wanted these things. Even the West Germans, the great founding chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany, Konrad Adenauer, he was quite clear about this. He's in 1956, he says, we must produce them. We have to produce the nuclear weapons ourselves. And he thought that there would be various ways in which West Germany could acquire a nuclear capability under her own control. Does this mean he was awful or aggressive or, this was like the Nazis all over again? By no means, right? If you think about these issues, you realize that if you're on the front line and you're threatened with nuclear attack, can you really count on the United States to defend you? Because, well, what would America do if the Soviet Union attacked West Germany? We would escalate to World War III. We would attack the Soviet Union ourselves. Isn't that the basic strategy? Well, would we really do it if push came to shove and the Soviets were capable of retaliating to that American attack by destroying American society? Right? Wasn't it totally rational for the Europeans to worry about these things, especially for a country like West Germany that was so exposed to Soviet military power? Didn't it make sense to hedge against the rather strong probability that the Americans might back out in the end by developing a nuclear capability of one's own? Right? So the Adenauer strategy, it makes eminent sense. They like this sort of thing. The Soviets, of course, knew all about this stuff. They knew more about it than the American public, that's for sure. Why? Because not just NATO, but the West German state was thoroughly penetrated by Soviet intelligence agents. In a country like West, like Germany, a divided country, it was very easy for the communist East Germans to send people, supposedly refugees, from East Germany to West Germany, where they would work their way into the West German government. You know, they spoke the language, they automatically had citizenship, and so on. And so the Soviets had a very good intelligence operation going in West Germany, in fact, in NATO as a whole, right? You know, you had a lot of these NATO countries, France and Italy, very large communist parties, especially, you know, big following among the, scientific community. You know, NATO was penetrated. Not bad from our point of view, if we have a deterrence philosophy. Right? We want the enemy to know what our plans really are, to kind of scare them and keep them from doing any, you know, really getting out of line. All right. So anyway, the Soviets are aware of this stuff, and they're concerned about what's going to happen. And so what do they do? Well, first they try the soft route. There were all these plans in the mid-50s for a nuclear-free zone in Central Europe. They got the Polish foreign minister, a man named Rapotsky, to propose this plan. It's called the Rapotsky Plan. You don't have to remember this name. The key thing is they try and go the soft route of let's have some sort of arrangement that keeps nuclear weapons out of West German hands, and in exchange will also include East Germany, Poland, and Czechoslovakia in this nuclear-free zone. All right, the Americans don't buy it. I mean, how could they, given the MC-48 strategy? And then it becomes clear that this isn't working, so the Soviets say there's no alternative to a tougher policy. And this is when they decide to lay on the Berlin crisis. This is November of 1958. Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, he gives this speech, and he basically says, enough time has passed after the end of the war. We have to kind of clean up all the relics left by the war. Among these relics is this bizarre anomaly of West Berlin, this Western military enclave in the middle of East Germany, right? It's like, this shouldn't be, it's a relic of the occupation. By now the occupation should be ended. We have these two German states. They're the ones that by rights should control their own territory. And he says, but I'm gonna be generous. Instead of simply demanding that West Berlin be turned over to East Germany, I'm going to allow West Berlin to become a free city. You know, but it can't be under the military protection of the three Western powers anymore, which meant there was nothing protecting it. Right? And then he says, and I'm going to give the Western powers 6 months to negotiate an arrangement of this sort. And if they don't do it, then we're going to move ahead unilaterally, and the rights of the Western powers that they had, you know, from the wartime period, we're going to liquidate them. Those rights will disappear, and this included the right to supply West Berlin. And if the Western powers actually have the audacity to try and enforce their rights by using, you know, military forces, and actually, you know, invade East German territory on the way to West Berlin, well, we will rise up in defense of our East German ally. In other words, he's threatening war in the event that the Western powers don't go along with his plan to liquidate the rights that they had gotten at the end of the war with regard to West Berlin. Right? Does he want war? Of course not. You know, military balance is so unfavorable. And if he wanted war, war isn't going to give the Western powers 6 months warning in order to prepare for it. You know, it's obviously not the case. So you have to say, what's his goal? What's, you know, so you look at all the different possibilities. Did he want to just take over East Berlin? West Berlin? Say, you know, well, there are all these refugees leaving East Germany through Berlin. It was an open city at that time. You just take the subway going from one part of Berlin to the other. Okay. Didn't he need to kind of, take over West Berlin to kind of stabilize the East German state? The answer there is no, because you could just do it by sealing the border. When the East Germans asked Khrushchev during this period, can't we just seal the border? And he said, no, I have bigger fish to fry. There are more important things I want to do. I want to keep this thing alive. Right? It's not, you see, they don't have any interest in taking over West Berlin, because West Berlin is a strategic liability for us. It's our Achilles heel. Very easy for the Soviets to apply pressure on us by threatening our position in West Berlin. Why would they want to squander that? Right? If we didn't have any military presence in West Berlin, then we would be free to move ahead, like with arming West Germany however we liked, and the Soviets wouldn't be able to do anything about it. West Berlin is our Achilles heel, and therefore it's an advantage to them. What could it have been? Why would they lay on the Berlin crisis? Timing and some of the statements make it fairly clear that it had to do with the nuclear armament of West Germany. What the Americans were doing in terms of allowing the West German Bundeswehr to get effective control over American nuclear weapons. They don't quite put it that way because they don't like to display their own vulnerability, their own anxiety. So, you know, they compensate for their weakness by engaging in this appearance of toughness and bluster and so on. But it's clear that these are real concerns. Okay? How do the Western powers react? See, Eisenhower's not worried because he knows what the military balance is. As a matter of fact, there are people high up in the American military that like the idea of taking advantage of this to have a war. They think a war is inevitable. We might as well fight it at a time when we're really strong. Like this General Twining, for example, Air Force Chief of Staff. Eisenhower doesn't think in those terms at all. Eisenhower, he thinks that the whole Berlin business is a can of worms. He had warned President Roosevelt against it when these arrangements were being worked out in toward the end of World War II. He wants to liquidate the whole Berlin problem. He knows that it's a source of weakness for the United States, and he's willing to go pretty far in terms of abandoning standard Western positions in order to strike a deal with the Soviets. The main thing has to do with recognition of the legitimacy of the East German state. You know, East Germany was singled out. You know, we recognized all these other communist regimes, Poland and Czechoslovakia and Bulgaria and so on, obviously the Soviet Union itself, but not East Germany. East Germany had less legitimacy than the other communist satellites. And there were a whole bunch of reasons why it was done. It was to kind of keep open the hopes of the West Germans for a future unification of their country. The more you move toward recognizing East Germany, the more you would kind of foreclose those hopes. Okay. So they were willing to work out these kind of de facto arrangements where you allow the East German frontier guards to stamp documents and so on. Eisenhower said, All these West German concerns about moving in that direction, they're silly. Basically, we could reach a kind of, you know, working accommodation with the East on lots of these issues, if that's all they want. But on this one firm, on one area, he took a very tough line, and this was this whole question of the nuclear armament of NATO. He was not going to give way on that. He was not going to give way on his policy of allowing the NATO allies to develop, in effect, nuclear forces of their own. Right? And the Germans also. The Germans didn't like the idea of a tough line here. Right? On the other hand, they pushed for a rather intransigent negotiating position. You know, those are things that didn't make sense. You want, you're intransigent in negotiations, but you don't want to, you know, even contemplate the eventuality of going to war. Famous story told by the American Foreign Service officer, who was the interpreter for Secretary of State Dulles when he met Chancellor Adenauer in December of 1958. And they talked about what would we do if the Soviets followed through on their threats and liquidated the Western rights in Berlin, you know, a few months down the line. And then Dulles laid out American policy, which was gradual escalation, culminating in the use of nuclear weapons. And Adenauer kind of looks at him and says, for God's sake, not for Berlin. On the other hand, they take a very hard line of negotiations. But the Americans kind of put a lot of pressure on them, and the Soviets give way, the Germans give way on all these issues except for one, which is the nuclear status of the Bundeswehr. The Americans aren't going to push them on this. The British don't like the idea of a tough line at all. The French take a rather interesting position, not substantively different from the Americans, but they think in the final analysis the Americans are not going to go to war for the sake of Western Europe, let alone for Berlin. They don't think that Americans should, but they say when that happens, the whole Western system will collapse, and we need to put something in its place. What would that something be? Some sort of Franco-German structure that could provide a European framework for balancing Soviet power. And so the French are relatively open during this period to the nuclear armament of Germany. So the whole inter-allied aspect of the Berlin business is a bit of a mess. Eisenhower, though, manages to get the Allies to kind of go along with the American policy, firm but not truculent. We don't give way on substance, but we're willing to kind of talk. And in fact, he offers to meet Khrushchev, who comes to the United States in September of 1959. He meets him. The Soviets, as part of what the arrangements that are worked out, they agree to kind of put off their ultimatum. The deadline is lifted. And there's supposed to be a summit conference with the three Western powers to deal with this German question to be held in Paris in May of 1960. But in the run-up to the summit conference, it becomes quite clear that there's no real chance for a settlement. Neither side is going to give way on substance, and that means that the Americans come to the conclusion that, well, the summit conference is going to fail, and then we're going to have a showdown. So we got to get ready for the showdown. And a showdown means we have to be prepared to escalate to the level of general nuclear war, which means we need to get as good target intelligence as possible. Which means that we have to send over these very high-flying U-2 spy planes over Soviet territory to take photographs so that we could see exactly what we want to hit, right? And one of these U-2 spy planes is actually shot down while the Paris summit is going on in May, giving Khrushchev an excuse to kind of break up the summit. How outrageous it is that other countries are conducting intelligence operations against us. Of course, we would never do that ourselves, right? Paris summit fails, and all these people saying, we're going to move into a really serious crisis now. It could lead to war. Nothing of the sort happens. In fact, the U-2s had demonstrated how serious the Americans were about getting ready for a war, and that was enough to intimidate Khrushchev and get him to back off. Right? So the Berlin business is put on the back burner for the rest of the Eisenhower period. Right? There's an election in November of 1960. Kennedy wins. He squeaks by with a very narrow margin and takes office as president in January of 1961. Very soon after that, the Soviets start up again with Berlin, leading to the most severe phase of the Berlin crisis, the phase of 1961-62. The showdown culminates in the Cuban Missile Crisis of October of 1962, which, by the way, is the real meaning of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And it's in that cauldron of a very sharp crisis that the elements of a stable international order fall into place. This whole crisis period is followed by the coming into being of a virtual settlement, a tacit settlement, settlement of 1963. So let me end with that now, and I'll pick up next time with the Berlin business under Kennedy in 1961.